Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Joseph Bottom is set to lead the Classics Institute at Dakota State University in Madison. Classics, in this case, is an acronym. It stands for Collaboration for Liberty and Security Strategies for Integrity in a Cyber-Enabled Society. Joseph Bottom is a best-selling author. His books include The Sociological Study, An Anxious Age, and the South Dakota memoir, The Christmas Plains. His writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post. He's joining us today from Hot Springs for a conversation about liberty, cyber ethics, and the future of classics at Dakota State. Dr. Joseph Bottom, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks for having me.
Pretty major announcement for Dakota State. How long has it been in the works?
It happened all very quickly. President there, Dr. Griffiths, had led this initiative to establish something called MAD Labs, these cyber-enabled laboratories in Madison and at Dakota State. And the dean of arts and sciences there, Ben Jones, insisted that the school needed a philosopher, and one of the components of MAD Labs was going to be this Classics Institute, which really is an attempt to apply humanities to the questions raised by the computer revolution over the last 40 years. And the combination just somehow clicked. Someone pointed this out to me, and I got in conversation with Dean Jones and went over and visited the school and gave a little lecture. And before I knew it, I signed up.
Applying humanities to the computer and cyber revolution, is that something that's happening across the country? Is it something that we're sort of hatching here in South Dakota?
I think it's relatively new. There are certainly people who are thinking about this. Google has a little institute in Ireland that they call the ethical hacking in this field, although that's more precisely directed toward questions of cybersecurity and raises questions about what do you do with bad guys who've been trained up as hackers? Do you hire them into the good guy side? What do you do with them? But I think there are bigger issues about the nature of politics, the nature of the political unity that we have, social issues, and the nature of polite conversation and how we manage that, and metaphysical issues about the nature of reality. And all of these, you know, we have thousands of years of human contemplation about through art, through literature, through philosophy, through theology. And that vast resource of deep human thought needs to be applied to these questions in a way that I think not many people are doing. And really, Dakota State is to be applauded, I think, for the vision of the president, the vision of the dean, that this is something that Dakota State could do and needs to do.
Is it something you had spent a fair amount of time contemplating yourself, or are you finding that there's a learning curve for you to really figure out, you know, how to structure a program at this point?
Well, I'm such a magpie, you know, and collect every bright and shiny object that goes by. So I've really, you know, thought about this, but it's been in a way that hasn't been systematic up till now. And the opportunity to take a position and head an institute and teach a little bit is an opportunity for me to apply extended time to these questions in a way that, with all my other writing commitments, I'd not been able to do so up till now.
What are some of those, when we talk cyber ethics, let's get into the guts of it a little bit and say, you know, what are those big questions? We mentioned one, this notion of hackers, and, you know, what do we do with them? Do we try to turn them to, you know, to be on our team? What are the other sort of big picture questions that you think jump out that need to be dealt with front and center?
Well, in the nature of law and the polity and our political unity, the fact is right now that basically every phone call you make, every text you send, every communication you have with another human being is recorded and can be searched. Now, we have an assurance that there's a kind of anonymity because the amount of data is so massive that it's not worth anybody's time to go trolling through it. But the fact is, if you are ever accused of a crime, you have a history which anyone in law enforcement can go back and search. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're not doing it until they have reason to focus on you is little assurance of the kind of privacy that we assumed human beings had for 200 years. And this is a question, then, about what we do with this. The fact is that it puts enormous power in the hands of law enforcement. Anyone accused of a crime, anyone whom the crosshairs focus upon, now becomes the object of a search, and they can troll through an enormous amount of data looking for some crime that you might have committed, some indiscretion. With the leaking that's going on and our apparent inability to stop that, that means that even embarrassing things, which don't amount to crimes, will come out once the focus has shifted onto you. This is extremely dangerous, but it's not something that we have not thought about before. The technology makes it pressing. The technology makes it worse. But the idea of scapegoating, the idea of rivalry, of imitation, the kind of things that are happening today, we've had thought about in theology and in philosophy. And we need to bring that thought and apply it to these questions.
Do you think the potential for lack of privacy as we text and as we email, does that raise the bar for our character as we consider now that everything we share and send might be made public? Or does it bring us down into the gutter of digging out information from people? And I'm not specifically talking about legal, you know, if you're committing a crime, but just, you know, those embarrassing things of when you're petty, when you're, you know, not your best self. Are we raising the bar and making us consider our own behavior and our own words more carefully? Or are we lowering it because of what we're putting in the public space?
Well, you know, we've shifted in many ways to a fame society, from an honor society to a fame society. The way in which you gain public notice, the way in which you establish yourself as a person of consequence is by the mechanisms of fame. But, of course, that puts the focus on you. And almost no one seems to escape. It's to watch Twitter, for instance, to read it, is to see a kind of high wire act in which you know the person is going to fall. They're going to make a mistake. And that mistake is going to be devastating. Years ago, the Beatles put out an album. In America. It was a kind of compilation of stuff that hadn't made it onto American albums. And they put a picture on the cover, an artsy photograph, of them posing with broken pieces of baby dolls and pieces of meat. And there was a reaction to it, a negative reaction to it, and they quickly pulled it and replaced it with an anodyne cover of the Four Mop Tops.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't ruin their career. But that kind of misstep, misjudging of the American temperature, the national social temperature, nowadays is devastating. Some poor woman made a joke a couple years ago, a stupid joke on Twitter about how the rate in Africa was so high of AIDS infections that she was hoping she didn't catch AIDS on her way to Africa. Then she got on her plane. Flew to Africa, several hours of flying. She gets off the plane in Africa, turns on her cell phone, and discovers that there are something like a million tweets denouncing her.
I remember this.
And she's fired
right
from her job. I mean, her career is in tatters because of this one misstep. Mm-hmm. But if she doesn't tweet, if she doesn't sort of have an online presence, then increasingly we tend to think that people are not real. So we have this strange combination of, you know, understanding there's an old line of Ovid's, which Descartes took as his motto, he lives well who is well hidden. That was Descartes' motto. The first books were published anonymously.
Okay.
And Descartes understood this kind of old social convention that you never want the focus of public attention to fall on you.
Right.
Because it's dangerous. We sort of forgot that. And you have to establish yourself online as a presence, as a real person. And yet every moment that you do is a dangerous moment, because if the focus falls on you, it will destroy you.
Mm.
Add to that one last piece, which is that the anonymous nature, the apparently anonymous nature of online commenting breaks some of the old social conventions about manners. To read the comments under a news article or an opinion piece is to read a kind of anger and vituperation and nastiness that would have never made it into public life in America before.
Did Descartes find that that anonymity gave him more intellectual freedom?
He certainly thought so.
Mm. And do we still have that in a way, or are we losing that because of the consequences of sort of all of us living a public life?
I'm just unsure of what's going on in American universities. There's much news, but I don't know how much to credit it.
Right.
If some of the news is right, though, we are less free intellectually than we were 50 years ago. It's more dangerous to take a position against whatever is the received opinion on American campuses today. Now, it seems to be more true of the liberal arts schools than it is of the technology schools and the engineering schools. And as I say, I'm not sure of how to take the reporting that I see about, say, Evergreen College in the Northwest, mm-hmm. or the shouting down of speakers at Berkeley or UCLA.
Sure.
But I think in general, people are more frightened than they used to be about putting outre ideas. There's a kind of writing that several people I knew over the years did, which is they had to write to find out what they thought.
Right, yeah.
And they would sort of try ideas on for size to see if they agreed with them,
mm-hmm.
and push a thesis to its extreme to find out where it goes. And those kinds of moves, writerly moves, seems to me are very dangerous today.
Right. And even just, as you said, I'm thinking of Betsy DeVos giving a speech on campus and, you know, students turning their back. Every student there now has to make a decision. If I face her, does that mean one thing? If I turn my back, does that mean something else? And they have to make that decision fairly quickly, and the consequences to that could affect their job search within 2 months of the event. Are we asking a little too much of our college students to sort of have to cast their lots with, you know, how they're going to behave?
Well, you know, the Instagramming of photographs and the rest means that nothing goes away.
Right.
You know, so that you make a mistake, and it's a pretty minor mistake, but, you know, like you turn your back on a speaker. Well, anybody can find that now.
Right.
You apply for a job, and every employer I know, when they get to their list of finalists, they Google every one of them to see, you know, what the news is. And it would be dangerous of them not to do it. Because say that you were going to hire somebody at the radio, and then you find out that they once expressed some mild admiration for the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
You know, you would be...
You need to know that, yeah.
Right, but you'd also be, if you didn't know that, and it came out in an article in the Argus Leader, the whole station would be embarrassed. So you have a duty to find out this kind of stuff. And minor mistakes and the mistakes of youth are no longer... have the kind of forgettability that they once had.
Joseph Bottom is going to be the director, or is the director, of Dakota State University's Classics Institute. We're going to take a quick break and return with Dr. Bottom here in just a moment for more on this conversation about ethics in a cyber-enabled world. Stay in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to continue our conversation now with Dr. Joseph Bottom. We're reaching him in Hot Springs. He is leading the Classics Institute at Dakota State University in Madison, a brand new think tank group. I don't know, how do you describe it? The Classics Institute, I guess.
The president, Dr. Griffiths, has described it as DSU's, the Dakota State's think tank.
Great. Okay.
Which is going to reach out to businesses, you know, that are working in this field, to the government, with which DSU has a very close relation in the building of these secure laboratories and the training of students as security analysts, and, you know, the general academic community, and try and raise notice of these questions and thereby raise notice of the school.
What are your aspirations for the Institute, for the think tank, as it regards the students when they come? How will it change their education in a way that you hope they'll be able to take forward into society as they find work?
I think that one of the goals has to be a development of a fairly stable and robust special ethics. Ethics is usually divided into general ethics, which is all talk of ethical questions, and special ethics directed toward a specific field. So the ethical guidelines of the American Medical Association or the American Bar Association for Lawyers, these are examples of special ethics. There is no well-established and robust and firmly based professional ethics for the people who are working in cybersecurity and the allied fields. And I think one of our goals has to be a development of that special and professional ethics. A larger goal, and I think a more important goal for the students, is an introduction to general ethics, which is to say a realization that everything they do needs to be considered in the light of ethics. It needs to be examined under a bright light that asks the question, ought I to be doing this at all? Is this a good thing? How does this relate to the ethical canons of my religious faith? How does this relate to the attitudes of stoicism and personal formation? How does this relate to a kind of Immanuel Kant's ideas? How does this relate to seriousness of purpose and seriousness of life? Otherwise, the students are divorced from a great tradition, the great tradition of Western thought, which is the taking seriously in thought of what we do and what we say and how we live.
Is there a distinction, a clear distinction between character and ethics?
Character is what you have when you behave ethically.
Okay. Thank you. I say, when you speak like that, I think, well, this is good character. So character is what you have when you speak. Is it also, and just a little side note here, is it a good time for those kids who aren't necessarily going to end up as coders or programmers or engineers, the humanities set, is it a good time to be studying ethics and philosophy maybe like never before because of an opening in a field of way it can be applied in special ethics?
Well, I think you've answered your own question. I mean, always every age feels its questions to be enormously pressing and enormously weighty in a way that history has never seen before. Every age imagines that it's historically unique. And, of course, the next age looks back and says, well, that was just like every other age. It had its own historical questions, and it tried to solve them as best it could. I do think, however, that there is something about the computer revolution that has tightened the screw on us all. And these questions become much more important. The question of whether you're going to live a public life, the question of whether you're going to Facebook and tweet, the question of whether you're going to, it's possible to escape the online machine. These are serious ethical questions, and they're questions about how you're going to live your life. And the resources for thinking about them clearly exist, and they have existed for hundreds of years in this great tradition from Aristotle to Thomas Aquinas to Immanuel Kant and down to us, and serious thought about ethical issues. And it seems to me that you don't have to be a genius and you don't have to be a professionally trained philosopher to get the basics of how it is to apply this seriousness of thought to the life that you want to live, to the work that you're doing. And without those resources, in fact, you'll find it much easier to be a cheat, much easier to be a get-alonger who drifts into immoral or bad actions or just meaningless actions because you've never risen to the level of self-contemplation. But a philosophical training, even in its mild form, and it's of an undergraduate course or two, offers resources to help you through the rest of your life. The same is true, I think, of all the humanities at their best. And here I do want to say, you know, the computer revolution has made some of the humanities stuff infinitely easier. There's a collection now online, originally on CDs, now online, that has put the entire corpus of literature in ancient Greek online and has made it electronically available. That's every word we have from Homer to inscriptions all the way up to the fall of Constantinople in the 15th century. Hmm. Every word we have of ancient Greek is now available for online electronically. That means that an undergraduate with a reasonable knowledge of ancient Greek can do the work in half an hour that we used to give PhD dissertations for. We used to give doctoral degrees for dissertations that were word counts. How many times does Aristotle use to antos, the Greek, ancient Greek verb to be, for the verb to be? How many times does he use that? We used to give PhDs to people who went through and counted and analyze the different ways that Aristotle used that word. Now, as I say, an undergraduate with half an hour can produce that work.
Wow.
That's an amazing thing, and it makes the kind of research that scholars do unbelievably easier than it used to be. Hmm. So, for every bad thing we want to say about the computerizing of our social condition, we can add a good word, and that's exactly the problem, because we don't know how to weigh these things one against the other or ameliorate the bad while helping the good.
The majority of our listeners right now are not college students, undergraduate students. There are folks who are working in jobs that have changed rapidly over the last few years that they've even been doing them. Is there sort of a remedial ethics work or a check-in or you know, some sort of message you would have for those people who are curious right now about what ethics means in a cyber-enabled society as it relates to their lives?
No, unfortunately, there isn't. We don't have a good book on this yet. We have a lot of apocalyptic books which mm-hmm. say the sky is falling. We have a lot of utopian books, Ray Kurzweil and these people who say, not only is the sky not falling, the sky is raising and we're all going to live forever if we upload our consciousness onto the web.
Right.
And I find both of these views implausible. We are all going to die. That is the key to ethics. We are all going to take advantage of the opportunities that our age offers us. We are all going to have to live with the situation we have now. It is neither as apocalyptic as some people seem to think, nor is it as utopian as others seem to think. Like all human things, it's muddled. And we don't have a clear sense yet, in this historically brief time of 40 years, in which the results for society of the computerizing of the world have yet to be worked out.
Hmm. Mortality as a key to ethics. How come?
Well, of course, I'm referring to Socrates, who said, philosophy is learning how to die. If we didn't die, nothing would matter.
Right.
And consequently, there would be no concern for ethics.
Scientists who are trying to, achieve sort of the fountain of youth or immortality in some way through technology, on the wrong path?
If they can extend life, great. If they think they are going to achieve immortality, I think that they're going to be surprised when they get a little older. I had a student once who told me we were working some logic problem and about infinite regress, and I said, you can't follow it out because you're going to die. We are not infinite. And he raised his hand, a serious kid, an engineering student, and he said, as though he were saying out loud a thought for the first time, he said, I'm not going to die. Because by the time that I get old enough to die, medical science is going to have cured whatever it is that I was going to die of.
Mm-hmm. And you responded.
I remember thinking, oh, does life have some surprises in store for you?
Sorry about that. Dr. Joseph Bottom, we're going to leave that there, for our time is short, but we hope you will come back and visit us again and again as you embark on this new role here at Dakota State University. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Joseph Bottom. We reached him in Hot Springs. He'll be the director of Dakota State University's Classic Institute. It's a think tank that dives into issues of cyber ethics in a world of cybersecurity, and so much more.